Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are live from Bismarck, North Dakota, about an hour drive from the main camp at Standing Rock. Last Thursday, the standoff between water protectors and police from six states escalated. The water protectors occupied Energy Transfer Partners' land that's in the path of the construction of the pipeline. According to the Indigenous Environmental Network, police in riot gear from six states arrived with eight ATVs, five armored vehicles, two helicopters, and a number of military-grade Humvees. They were armed with batons, tasers, mace, pepper spray, rubber bullets, percussion grenades, a sound cannon, and other so-called less lethal ammunition. People on the front line were maced and shot and hit with beanbag rounds. At least 142 people were arrested, including elders. One person riding a horse was reportedly hit with up to four rubber bullets. His horse was hit in the legs by live rounds, and another horse was shot and did not survive. For months now, members of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Native Americans from more than 300 tribal nations and their non-Native allies, have been resisting the construction of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Oil Pipeline, which would transport up to 570,000 barrels of oil per day from North Dakota down through South Dakota, through Iowa, and to Patoka, Illinois. That's the final destination. Altogether, the pipeline would pass through 59 counties. Water protectors here in North Dakota are concerned about the pipeline crossing the Missouri River. That provides drinking water to 18 million people, and it's also the main source of drinking water for the tribe. That section of the pipeline cannot be completed without government approval. At this time, most of the pipeline has been completed. In fact, the pipeline route near the main camp at Standing Rock is now being protected by police and military vehicles. It is no longer accessible. So on today's Your Call, we are continuing our conversation about what's happening at Standing Rock, what's next. Why has this movement galvanized so many people around the country and around the world? And today we're joined by Candy Mossett, a member of the Mandan and Hadatsa tribes. Candy is a Native energy and climate campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network based here in North Dakota, and she joins us near the main camp. Hi, Candy. Welcome to the show. We're also joined by Mary Annette Pember, a member of the Red Cliff Ojibwe tribe. Mary is an independent journalist focusing on Native issues for Indian Country Today and other publications. And Mary joins us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Hi. And by the way, my tribe is pronounced Ojibwa.
Ojibwa. Thank you. And Candy, are you with us?
I am.
Okay, great. Thank you for joining us. So, Candy, I want to give people a sense of what this all looks like, because before I came out here about 3 weeks ago, I had a hard time just visualizing everything. Last time, I was able to drive from Bismarck, which is where I am now, about 40 minutes from the main camp, along Highway 1806. But when I arrived this time on Saturday, I hit a checkpoint and was told to turn around and take a different highway. And right next to that checkpoint was a large law enforcement tent. So can you tell us, why was Highway 1806, why is it still closed? I mean, to get here, I had to go an extra 20 minutes this morning.
That's a great question. We're questioning that ourselves. Down further on Highway 1806, they actually have a barricade set up on the bridge, which is just north of the camp by yards. And they were cleaning it up yesterday, is what I saw, but there were tanks. Humvees, I keep calling them tanks. They look like tanks to me. It's military equipment. So two big, huge MRAP machines that are military-grade vehicles, Humvees, military Humvees, and police, they're all blocking the bridge. They're blocking us from leaving the camp and going north. So we can go around on Highway 6, but the reason is because the police and the Army National Guard are protecting Energy Transfer Partners and Dakota Access Pipeline. They are protecting the easement. They are not allowing us to go onto our original 1851-1868 Fort Laramie Treaty lands, which is unceded treaty territory. There are over 380 sacred sites in that corridor, and they are denying us access and protecting the pipeline so they can dig and trench and put the pipe in the ground all the way up to the Army Corps of Engineers land. And in the law books, they say this is legal because...
Oh, Candy, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay.
In the law books, they say this is legal because Dakota Access Energy Transfer Partners purchased the Cannonball Ranch. Now, that purchase was done in what looks to be an illegal land sale because we are protected by a North Dakota farming law from industry. However, with that law, whoever purchases that land has a whole entire year before they have to deal with it or give the land back, or it's a $100,000 fine. So when we're talking about a multi-billion-dollar project, $100,000 for them is like pocket change, and they're able to get away with these things on paper, which if you go back to the 1851 treaty, the treaties were never kept between the United States government and us. And it's a huge problem because we're not supposed to be here anymore. This country literally tried to terminate the Native people, and now it's flaring up again. And the language that we're hearing is that these police are being sent in from at least five other states to deal with the quote-unquote Indian problem, which is us trying to protect clean drinking water for everyone.
And again, just to give listeners a visual, so again, Highway 1806, the main highway from Bismarck to the main camp at Standing Rock, is now closed to through traffic. And the pipeline route is being protected by police and large military vehicles. I was just there yesterday. You can walk up almost to the edge of where there are these burned out cars and then these huge cement blocks. And so if you've seen video of the protests, a number of water protectors were there at the root of the pipeline preventing the workers from coming in. Well, now that the pipeline is being, in essence, protected by police and military vehicles, the work is being done. And Candy, last night at the camp, I saw these huge lights. And so we saw tractors yesterday. There are ATVs driving along the hill. I'm told they're driving over 11 burial sites. To your knowledge, is construction now happening 24/7?
Yes, construction is happening 24/7. They're using the floodlights to be able to see at night. They are on top of a burial site. We can see them from the Media Hill. We can see them. There's a small tree on that hill, and there are 11, if not more, graves on top of that hill. That's why we were praying yesterday. And there are ATVs and there are snipers in the hills. We have binoculars looking back at them, and they are pointing guns at us in the camp. There was a small brush fire started 2 days ago when we called for help. One person said that the police department hung up on them and said there is no fire. There are two recorded 911 calls where we called 911 and they said that there was a jurisdiction issue, that they couldn't send fire trucks to put out the fire. And then the second call said that the bridge was compromised, so they couldn't send anyone. 6 hours after that fire was started, a helicopter came and dumped water, and it burned right across from our camp. And nobody feels safe there. There are people that are on our side of the line that are working with the police. There are things that are happening that are not happening by us. They're happening by paid people that are in our camp. We've seen them throwing rocks at police. They are not with us. We saw them starting fires, and they're not with us. And so it's so much bigger than anyone can even understand. There are infiltrators in our camp, and we have irrefutable evidence to this. And it's really, to me, it's scary, and it's also, people are telling me, well, you know, it's a multi-billion-dollar corporation, and look at what happened, at Wounded Knee, and, you know, it's like I'm not supposed to be surprised by it, but I really am. I'm really shocked by it. In 2016, that it happens, and it happens in our country, and it's just really hard to know that we're trying to protect water, and this is what's happening to us.
And Mary, I have not seen much reporting about this. I've been trying to get information from the sheriff's office about these police departments from at least five other states that are coming in to assist. Do we know if they're just police? Is there a mix of security from the Energy Transfer Partners company? How much of this has been approved by the governor of North Dakota? I've also left his office multiple messages and haven't received any callbacks. Have you been able to get answers to these important questions?
Well, it's encouraging they're not calling you back either. I thought maybe they were weren't calling me back because they figured out who I was writing for. But, you know, I think some of it, in their defense, if you will, they are really overwhelmed, particularly if you think about Morton County, which is this little, they probably don't normally deal with this sort of level of, you know, things going on in their jurisdiction. But, you know, that's a really good question. They do have a compact, this agreement with several states. And Ohio, I know, Indiana, I think South Dakota, maybe Minnesota. And some of the citizens of those states are letting their leadership know that their political leadership know that they're not happy with that. They don't want their tax dollars spent, you know, for law enforcement to be sent to protect these corporate interests.
Another question that is still outstanding, and Mary, you've also looked into this, and every time we do a show on this, we bring it up. So again, the pipeline is supposed to cross the Missouri River. That 20-mile section has not been completed yet. That provides drinking water to 18 million people. It's the main source of water for the tribe. And an early proposal called for the pipeline to cross the Missouri River north of Bismarck, an area that's 90% white. But the route was rejected because of a threat to the water supply. And then the pipeline was rerouted to pass under the Missouri River at Lake Wahe, right near the tribe's doorstep. And I've gotten a little bit of information from the Bismarck Tribune, and they report that the route was initially rejected because of a potential threat to the water supply. But I called Energy Transfer Partners and the governor saying, well, why is it not okay for the pipeline to, you know, not pass through Bismarck, but it is okay to basically go right to the tribe's doorstep? Again, I cannot seem to get that question answered, and a few local journalists I've interviewed have said the same. Mary, have you been able to get any answers?
No, not directly, but I think the reason is because they can, and they've gotten away with it. And I think the Army Corps of Engineers has a longstanding record with kind of pushing projects forward. I mean, I think if you notice, if you look at other federal agencies, they are unique in that really forwarding economic interests and building infrastructure is in their mission statement. You know, they have a history of kind of just, you know, considering it a foregone conclusion when they deal with tribes, and they have historically not done a very good job of consulting at all. And I think there's been some very legitimate charges that what the process in which they do that is illegal. And I think they've been sued successfully by not only by tribes, by counties and I think municipalities. So, I think they have a reputation of being rather insular as an organization. I do know I went to the NCAI, the National Congress of American Indians, meeting in Phoenix last month, and the Army Corps of Engineers. Now, I figure NCAI is sort of comparable. I sort of compare it like the NAACP for Native people. And it's a long-standing organization. It's been around for a very long time. This is the first time they have ever attended one of these annual conferences. And since their work frequently puts them in contact with tribes, it's pretty shocking. It's pretty notable, I think.
And Mary, I know we have to let you go, but because you're a reporter with Indian Country Today, and you've got experience covering Indian Country, were you surprised to learn that people were treated so badly in jail? People are being charged with felonies. They have been kept in jail for up to three days and three nights, handcuffed in front of their bodies, forced to go to the bathroom with handcuffs in front of their bodies. Elders were arrested. Their sacred items were taken from them. Does this surprise you at all?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't. I mean, I think, you know, Native people, we are actually the ethnic population most likely to die in our interactions with law enforcement. So I do know, you know, there have been, this is not the first time this type of thing has happened. This is the, I think what's notable is it's gotten the kind of attention that it has nationally and internationally. But for instance, my mother's reservation, Bad River, in Wisconsin, we had a kind of a comparable situation where Gogebic taconite wanted to drill this enormous hole in the ground to extract this kind of an iron ore that is quite difficult to extract. That is the Iron Range, but it had been sort of abandoned because it was too expensive to work. But at any rate, they're very sort of comparable. You know, they over militarized these kinds of interactions. You know, bringing in these kind of, you know, this kind of equipment that is, it's like, and when there's no indication that the people that they're dealing with are armed. So I think there's this pretty consistent effort, I think, to paint, you know, by corporate America, and then sort of supported, I think, often by the mainstream, to paint us as, you know, these lawless, you know, dangerous people.
And Mary, like you said, most of the mainstream coverage is now going to focus on the violence and the arrests. What I fear will get lost is that people have been here since April. You've got Native Americans from 300 tribal nations coming here, sleeping in tents, sleeping in the cold. And yes, it's about protecting the water, but for a lot of people, it's about so much more than that. It's about sharing their stories about what they're facing back at home. And what I heard yesterday was, we've got to go on a different path. What we're doing right now is just not working. That's what I keep hearing from people.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think no matter what does happen at the end of all of this, the really good news, the good story is that the federal government is taking note, you know, of the poor permitting process of federal agencies like the Army Corps of Engineers that basically have created their own means to answer what's called the National Historic Preservation Act. And what they've been doing is they're not doing meaningful consultation with tribes. They're not doing it. And the Obama administration has now called for a series of listening and consultation sessions with tribes, and those are going on now. I think there's actually one tomorrow, maybe in Billings. But they're going on throughout Indian country. And I think, Native people have got the federal government's attention. And, I'm not an attorney, but this looks pretty, it looks pretty good to me, you know, in terms of that we have, that there is success in litigating against the Army Corps of Engineers' use of this permitting process. And I think that, you know, we may see a big change. It may be comparable in many ways to what happened at Wounded Knee in terms of, you know, being a sea change in the relationship between tribes and the federal government. So, no, I mean, it's really terrible and shameful that this is the kind of thing that Native people have to go through to get the federal government's and the mainstream world's attention. But I'm really excited and confident that I think good things will happen. I really do.
Well, Mary, we'd love to have you back on the show, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It was an honor.
Thank you. Mary Annette Pember is a member of the Red Cliff Ojibwe tribe. She is an independent journalist focusing on Native issues for Indian Country Today and other publications. And she was here covering what's happening at Standing Rock. And joining us for the rest of the hour is Candy Mossett, a Native Energy and Climate Campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. Candy was on the front lines on Thursday. We'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. But if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. Today we're giving you an update about what's happening here in North Dakota at Standing Rock. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, tweet us, leave a message on our website. Just to give you an update on what's happening, there was a major crackdown on Thursday. Police from at least 5 states were in riot gear. They came with armored vehicles, a number of military-grade Humvees, batons, pepper spray, rubber bullets, you name it. A number of journalist colleagues who have covered overseas wars and uprisings said that they never thought that they would experience something like a war zone here in the United States, let alone in North Dakota. And so at this point, the pipeline is essentially being protected by police and military vehicles on both sides of the pipeline. Water protectors can no longer access it, and construction is now taking place 24/7. And Candy, you know, I know it's hard for you to go back there, but can you talk to us again about what happened on the front lines? I mean, you were right there. I saw even a video of someone shoving you right into the police. Did you expect the crackdown to be so intense?
No, I didn't. I was standing on the front line, and the police came, and they turned on their loud machine, and I was standing by the easement. The police were on the hill forming a line with their lights on and their sirens on. That's the first thing I saw. I was there. It was about 10:30 in the morning, and there was nobody on Highway 1806. There was nobody. I didn't see any military. I didn't see any police on Highway 1806. So I was doing a live stream, and that got scrambled, and so I recorded. And I walked down towards the easement, and I saw the police on the hill protecting the excavators and protecting the bulldozers so that what happened on September 3rd when Amy Goodman and others ran out to protect the burial sites, we were able to stop them that day. Well, this day, there were police protecting them. And so then I was down there, and I was triggered. I was, like, considering if I should run out onto the field or what I should do. But at that point, I was alone. The call was just now going to the frontline camp or down to the south, to the Ocheti Shakoin camp, that they were coming. And so I looked, and I saw horses running. I saw cars running. I saw people shouting. And I saw that then when I looked north, maybe 10 minutes or so later, I saw the Humvee, the tanks come over the hills. I saw the MRAP machines come over the hills or on 1806. I started seeing riot police walking towards us, and they were forming a line from one ditch to the other ditch. And then I heard a sound, and I thought it was a car alarm. And then I got closer, and it started hurting my ears, and I realized they were using the MRAP machine. It's a sound device to hurt ears, and it's one of the things that they use. But I think it's important for people to know that we were standing there looking them in the face, and yes, they had less lethal weapons on them. They had orange and green, but every single person that had less lethal weapons had actual machine gun type weapons on them, and this was confirmed that they wear both just in case. And we were pointed at by a guy in a tank with a sniper. This is confirmed. He's a sniper. His gun is not a less lethal gun. It's a real gun that he's pointing at the crowd the entire time. And we're standing there, and you can hear the videos, and we're saying, don't shoot us. Don't hurt us. We're praying. And I was sitting there, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what was happening. But see, everything escalated and escalated and escalated. When it first happened, they came up and they said, move back, move back. They were on a PA system, and we refused to move back. And so then they started coming forward. And when they started coming forward, we moved back, but we started building our barricade even more. At that point, just north of the frontline camp on the easement, the treaty camp, they stopped for about an hour. And I sat on a log in front of this police line, and I talked to them. And I cried, and I said, my grandfather's a World War II vet. He has two Purple Hearts. He landed on the beaches in Normandy. He stormed, you know, he was there when he was 18 on D-Day, and he walked around his whole life with a metal plate in his head fighting for this country. And I'm sure that he didn't do that for his granddaughter to be attacked by a militarized police force here in North Dakota. And I said, where were you, police? Why are you all here from all these states protecting a pipeline? I'm from the Bakken Shale oil fields where women and children are being raped and being kidnapped, and where there's sex trafficking and where drugs are coming in. There's organized crime in my community. There's heroin. I said, why aren't you there? Why are you here? And I went for an hour, and I tell you, I swear to you that two of those police officers were wiping tears from their eyes. Three of them put down their batons beside them instead of holding them in front of them. And they were hearing us, and they were listening to what we were saying. And our people kept talking to them about water and life, and their children. We're doing this for them. We're peaceful. We're unarmed. And so then the Morton County Sheriff's Department goes on and says a statement that we were saying awful things to them. But you, as you mentioned, I was shoved from behind, and it's a kid. He identified himself. He had been working within some of the camps. I saw pictures on his Facebook page since 2013. He has been in some of the trainings and different things that we have been doing. And you can clearly see on the Unicorn Riot video footage at minute 6:44, he points to the top of my head, and then he shoves me into the police line. And what I saw in front of me was the police communicating with him, though at the time I didn't know it. I thought they randomly targeted him because it was like they were getting ready to come in and catch. And they were nodding their heads like, yes. And so when they took him, I thought, oh, they got that guy, until I saw the footage. And I realized, oh, my God, they are here on our side of the line. I shouldn't be surprised, but I am. And it makes me think of Leonard Peltier. You know, yeah, sure, some people spent 3 days in jail. Leonard Peltier has been in there for 40 years for a crime he didn't commit. That's how powerful they are. And it puts it all into perspective. I had my hands up in the air with a feather in my right hand the entire time that I was standing out there. My hands are in the air, and a guy grabbed his taser, and the girl next to me said, look, this was after I got shoved and after they didn't get me. He grabbed his taser, and she goes, look, look. And I looked him in the eyes, and I said, please do not shoot us with that. And he put it back. Minutes later, another guy started grabbing his canister. It looks like a small fire extinguisher, the pepper spray. It's not a little handheld. It's a fire extinguisher size spray. And he started pointing at us, and I said, please do not spray us in the face with that. We're unarmed. And he put it back. It was like that the whole 2 miles that we walked backwards and walked backwards and listened to their commands and their orders as they told us to move back. And yet we were the ones targeted by such violence. And it wasn't until I saw the videos that I fully understood what was happening around me. They were dragging people out of sweat lodges. They broke a man's pipe in half in front of him. They broke up prayer circles and arrested elders. The woman that was arrested, one of the elderly women, went to jail, and she told them she needed to take her insulin. She came to our women's prayer ceremony the next morning on the bridge, 2 days later on the bridge, and she told us her story. They would not let her take her insulin. They refused to let her be untied, and she said, I feel that I'm going to have a seizure. I need to take my insulin. And mind you, she's like 70 or 80 years old. By the time they checked her blood sugar, it was 488. They had refused her for hours and hours and hours and had her handcuffed, and she has nerve damage from previous, and it was an extreme pain for like 3 or 4 hours. So they're doing these things to us, and it's all of it is completely unjustified. On the news, I'm watching the local news talking about a woman who had a gun. And where's the proof of this? Where's the evidence? We actually have video footage showing her holding a pipe and showing them tackling her, showing four police being on top of her, and then you hear three gunshots fired after she's already detained. We have footage of them picking up shell casings, the police, and putting them in their pockets. Where is that okay? Why aren't you supposed to leave a shell casing on the ground and come and mark it as evidence? Or do I watch too much CSI? I don't know. Why are they picking up shell casings and putting them in their pockets? All of this is on video footage that we have.
And Candy, actually, that is the lead story in today's Bismarck Tribune, protesters facing felony charges. They're writing about Red Fawn Fallis, who faces a maximum of 20 years in prison. She's being held on a $100,000 cash bond. She's a 37-year-old woman from Denver, and she's being charged with attempted murder.
She's the Leonard Peltier of our time.
That is Candy Mossett. We're going to take a phone call quickly before we go to break. Let's hear from Pancho. Hi, Pancho. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Sister Rose, for holding space and for this very important matter of all of us. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, and Sister Candy, I'm very moved and very, very touched. We're sending you all our love and prayers and beyond from Wuching, from here, from East Oakland. As I'm trying to articulate right now how to send all my love, I just only can tell how they can bring militarized police from seven different states, and many of us are getting ready also to get there. We're going to be there with you very soon, and we know people here in the Bay Area that have been participating in the Standing Rock Medic and Healer Council, and we know also that medics have been treated also very, very poorly, being arrested with the water protectors as well. And so we have a huge support, and also the moral ground is on our side. But I just want you to underscore and underline your courage and your bravery. Yeah, the people know that that's what happened with the Black Panthers and the American Indian Movement and the students for nonviolence in the 60s and 70s, and they're doing it again. But now, if we focus, when all this looks very, very complex, but if we focus on our means, the way that you are doing it, sister, I saw that beautiful picture of you with the eagle feather blessing the soldiers, and how you tell this story and how you touch the hearts of these police officers by putting their batons down. That's what we need, and we need to amplify this story. So spaces like these with these radio are so precious, and
thank you for showing
with your means, you know, because our means are our ends. So thank you for all that love and radical kindness and generosity.
You're welcome. I'll see you when you come, because I'll be there. We're not going anywhere. I think that's what's important. Everybody should know we're going to be there, and we're in ceremony, and we're grounded. We're returning to our prayer. It was told to us by our spiritual leader that we will be grounded in prayer, and we will be like stones, and we will win. And people that come, please, please, please be self-sufficient. Please know that it's cold. That you can't be staying in a tent. You know, plan to bring your own canvas tents and wood stoves, or plan to try to get a room either in Bismarck or at the Prairie Nights Casino, which is often filling up, because it's been really hard on us to go to the airport and pick people up and leave the camp and try to take care of people when they come in. We do it, of course, because we love everybody, but right now the filling in camp is so tense because we don't know who among us we can trust anymore. And people need to understand to be self-sufficient, to identify who you are, because what happened when we were attacked last Thursday has caused some post-traumatic stress disorder. I see it in people's faces. And so just be aware that we are under duress, and that we are in prayer, and that please be self-sufficient when you come.
Thank you again for calling. Today I'm speaking with Candy Mossett, a member of the Mandan and Hadatsa tribe. She's a Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network here in North Dakota. We're broadcasting live from Bismarck. It's about an hour from the main camp at Standing Rock. And I also want to mention, I have put several emails and phone calls over the last month and a half into the Sheriff's Office, the North Dakota Governor's Office, Energy Transfer Partners. I asked them to join the show. I never got a response. I have also been putting calls into the Department of Justice and the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps sent me to the DOJ, which sent me a statement saying that they have asked Energy Transfer Partners to voluntarily stop construction. So that's the key word there, voluntarily. So we have invited all of the parties, and I have not received calls back from the sheriff or the North Dakota governor or Energy Transfer Partners. This is your call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling us at 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. The lines are filling up quickly. When someone goes away, there'll be a line open. You can also post a comment at yourcallradio.org, send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And coming up tomorrow, we will continue our coverage from here in Bismarck, which is about an hour from the main camp at Standing Rock. And I'll be joined by Germaine Tremel. She's an international lawyer with the United Nations. She works on genocide cases. She is the great-great-great-granddaughter of Sitting Bull. Before this all took place, she and her family did not really talk about their lineage, but this really empowered them to come out and talk about their connections to Sitting Bull. So that will be tomorrow. And today, we are talking about the latest from Standing Rock. Today, I'm joined by Candy Mossett, a member of the Handan and Hidatsa tribes. Candy is a Native Energy and Climate Organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network based in North Dakota. And now I would like to welcome Simon Moya Smith to the show. Simon is Culture Editor with Indian Country Today. Hi, Simon. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi. And Simon, if you can speak up. We're all in different places right now, and I just want to make sure that the audio is clear for everyone listening. Simon, from a journalist perspective, can you talk about what's really struck you about the journalists coming into the camp and then what they're focusing on when journalists are interviewed by the national media, the questions that they're being asked? What really strikes you about that?
I think they're running with false reports. We understand that, you know, headlines sell, you know, juicy headlines sell. So when somebody will, like the Today Show reported the other day after what happened on Thursday about the alleged shooting on the side of the unarmed water protectors. But they didn't counter that. They didn't say, well, the water protectors, or as they're calling them, protesters, said that they didn't have a gun. They just left it there, that the police, that the sheriffs reported that they were fired at with a weapon on Thursday, and they just left that hanging there. And, you know, that reflects poorly on the truth. And so it's really difficult because there are not that many Native American journalists. We know how to report in our communities. We know the language. So again, when they were saying they were the sheriffs announced that they were word of pipe bombs because people were saying they were loading the pipe. Well, that's the Chinupa. That's the sacred pipe. This is how disconnected mainstream media is to Native Americans. They haven't invested in reporting in Native American communities. So when they go there, they walk away with the wrong language. And it's really difficult to get the mainstream media to pay attention because to them, we're too small of a minority for their turn and investment on reporting on Indian country. The largest story they've reported on was Thursday because they had to. They couldn't ignore it. Otherwise, they would look lazy or like they didn't care. But to them, they're wondering, okay, so what's the new angle? You know, it's just like that old saying, you know, what's new? What's new? To them, to the mainstream media, they're used to seeing armed police going after protesters or going after, and then Native Americans arguing that are fighting against treaty violations. They feel that this story has already been told over and over and over again. So those of us as journalists have to work tirelessly to convince them that it's worth their time to go out there and to stay out there. But then we have a problem because we want to make sure what they're filing is accurate and it doesn't demonize the indigenous people.
And Simon, as a journalist, this is an incredible story to cover because 1 hour you'll meet the great-great-great-granddaughter of Sitting Bull. The next hour you will meet, speaking from experience here, I met a man from Montana who is Native American. He was adopted, and his wife said, you need to go to the camp and find out who you are. And then I met a young man from a nearby reservation who said, you know, we don't have many opportunities. I'm bringing my brothers to find purpose. And then I also met a labor organizer from Madison, Wisconsin. And, you know, labor is really in favor of the pipeline, but some small unions have passed resolutions supporting the pipeline. I met that woman in the lobby of the hotel. It's just there's so many rich stories to tell here.
There are. But again, at the end of the day, we are much canceled out of the American conversation because it raises too many questions. It does. I mean, people will say reservation, but then they don't even ask what a reservation is. That goes too deep. A reservation was originally a prison camp. And people don't want to know that because it flies in the face of their happiness, of their blissful ignorance. So as indigenous peoples, we have to encourage them to pay attention to us, especially now, because look at this. one, I mean, just not even 1 week, a couple days after Thursday, or excuse me, before what happened on Thursday, Renee Davis, a pregnant mother of three, she was 5 months pregnant when she was shot and killed in her home by police. Native Americans are statistically more likely to die at the hands of police than any other demographic. So within a week's time, one of our mothers, one of our sisters, who suffered from a psychological condition, was killed by police. And in that same window of a week, there was the attack on the Standing Rock. And where is everybody? Where are the people standing up with us at large? We haven't heard any. Well, no, we did finally hear from Hillary Clinton, but that was a non-response. She was like, let them drill, let them build, and you guys protest, everybody do that peacefully. It was a nothing response. So right now, what we need is more people to pay attention to the discrimination of indigenous peoples that's been happening since the first white man got off the boat. This is nothing new. We're exhausted of having people come to us and say, well, why are things an issue now? Why are Indians fighting now about this, that, and the other? Our resistance is not new. What's new is social media. Their awareness of our resistance and simply our existence is new. So we are using this new form of technology, social media, to tell our own narrative. Back when our elders were at Wounded Knee in the 70s, unfortunately, they had to rely on the mainstream media that came in, took the photos, got the quotes, and then left. Now you have the indigenous people using this new technology to direct the narrative, to tell our own story, to refute on the bad reporting that you're going to see out there, the false reporting. So it's like citizen journalism right now is helping our community. Being the citizen journalist, holding up your phone, capturing what they're doing, and then also alternative media. Unicorn Riot is doing a fantastic job, but they're also being targeted because they're press. So press are being targeted. The indigenous people are being targeted. We're being targeted because we're fighting for treaty-protected land, and people need to understand that. Treaty-protected land, the Fort Laramie Treaty, they're on Fort Laramie Treaty territory. That is not their land to take. And that's the thing. They're not breaking treaties with other governments across an ocean because they have military armies and might. The United States is being a bully. The state of North Dakota is being a bully because they think that they can break treaties with Indians. Why? Because we're a small population of people? No, it's unjust. They can't. There's no moral high ground North Dakota has right now, neither the United States. When you go after indigenous peoples and our rights and our land the way they did Thursday, the way they did with Renee Davis in Washington, there's no justification for it.
Simon Moya-Smith is culture editor with Indian Country Today, and Candy Mossett is a Native Energy and Climate Campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. I did reach out to the Morton County Sheriff's Department and the governor of North Dakota's office so many times over the last 2 months, and I have yet to have any of my calls returned, but I am planning to go to the sheriff's office today and tomorrow in person to try to find answers to these questions about who's actually here, police, security guards, who are these people, and why are people being strip searched and charged with a felony? According to a number of people who've been arrested, they told me that if they did not submit to a DNA test, they'd be charged with two felonies. So a lot of questions remain unanswered. Let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for covering, and thank you so much, Candy, I just can't express my gratitude for all the work and my sadness for all that everybody is going through there. I was there on Saturday the 22nd. I believe that there was going to be a labor rally that was going to start on Saturday the 22nd. I'm a member of UPTE, the University and Professional and Technical Employees of Communication Workers of America, Local 9119 of the University of California, San Francisco. I'm a medical interpreter. And my mother was from Chile. So in Chile, we're pretty much have had experience and also post-traumatic stress disorder regarding military dictatorships. And when I went there and I saw the helicopters flying overhead, and while I was there from Saturday until Wednesday, it was reminiscent of that era in Chile under the dictatorship of Pinochet. I would also like to mention something that as a University of California employee, I was looking at the retirement plans at UCRP Holdings to see whether or not there was any investments that University of California had in Energy Transfer Partners, just out of curiosity. And I found, as of December 31st, 2015, that there's $3 million in shares in Energy Transfer Partners on the, by the University of California Retirement System. So I would really urge everyone that is listening to look into their retirement plans, to close their accounts with these major companies and banks that are financing this, because otherwise we will all be complicit in what is, we are all complicit in what is happening to the people at Standing Rock and to the Native people at Standing Rock and in other places, in other indigenous nations that are also fighting against these pipelines throughout the United States.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time. I will write down a Follow the Money show for a future program. Thank you for calling. And Harvey wanted to call in and say this weekend there were people protesting banks in San Francisco. There's a recent report linking the banks connected to the Dakota Access Pipeline. You should drop your bank account, he says, if you're linked to the pipeline, and move your money to a credit union. Yes, thank you. We will definitely do a show and follow the money. Candy, we have just about 5 minutes left, and I just wanted to ask you about organizing. Can you talk about how decisions are made in the camp? Because there are some separate camps, like one camp is about maybe a half a mile away, lots of different people involved here. How does that process work?
Well, the first camp is the Sacred Stone Camp that was there since April 1st, but when people came after the police violence first started in August, people came and there's not enough room. And so it was the camp just off of 1806, which became known as the Ocheque Shokoi Camp, has camps within the camp. And so there's like Red Warrior Camp, and there's like the Rosebud, the Sikanju, the different tribes have kind of grouped in their areas. And so what we've been doing is we've been having community, it's a community, so we have community meetings at 10 a.m. in the green tent, and then we have more meetings at 4 p.m., and we encourage camp members, camp leaders, to come to the meetings so that decisions can be made. We meet with the tribal council on a regular basis. David Archambault is often in the camp talking to us. We are continually meeting with the different district reps and talking about the next steps forward, because we do have next steps forward. We are talking about building and are now building a just transition community where we will put here on this land a mark that we were here, that people 10, 20 years down the road can come and see what we created out of this terrible, awful situation, which is a community based in love and based in renewable and off of fossil fuels. Our message is to keep fossil fuels in the ground and to move in a just transition toward renewables. So we're using solar power. When Mark Ruffalo came, he worked with Native Renewables, which is a 100% Diné-owned solar power company. Native Renewables is working with Empowered by Light and the Solutions Project. They brought and gifted two solar powers, solar panels. We have wind turbines. We have Henry Red Claw with Lakota Solar Enterprises. They have their solar. Greenpeace has their Rolling Light Solar. And so what we're doing is we're not just stopping an infrastructure project. We are showing the way forward. We are showing that there is a better way. It doesn't have to be business as usual. So people can come and see the earth lodges that we are going to be building shortly. The teepees are going up. The tiny homes are going up. The long houses are going up. The wigwam, like all these different tribes are building their own tribal units. And so we're making decisions on the ground based upon joint community involvement at our community meetings with the tribal council of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe involved and with their empowerment. But more importantly, maybe most importantly, is that our spiritual leaders are there. Chief Arvo Looking Horse and others are on the ground with the sacred bundles, with the ceremonies and the prayers, and we are grounding ourselves in ceremony and prayer so that we cannot be infiltrated the way we were when they're making it look like us being bad people, when in fact there are infiltrators making us look bad.
And quickly, Candy, I also met an older man, an elder, who was heavily involved with the American Indian movement back in the 70s, and he was crying as he was telling me that it's the first time that so many tribal members have come together. He said, in the past, there was so much friction, people were fighting amongst each other, and this time, at this camp, we are together for the first time. What is personally, I mean, you're so focused on getting the word out about the information in the camp, what it's like on the front lines, but when you step back and take a breath, what has this whole experience been like for you to interact with so many people from other tribes across the country?
It gives me the goosebumps. This was prophesized over 200 years ago and was put in the ground in that very site where Atreti Shikoni is. There was medicine, and it was talked about that we would come together in unity. There's a Hopi prophecy about all the colors of the rainbow coming together to fight in unity. And the fact that it's happening and it's here and it's now is, like you said, we take a step back. We take a step back from the violence and we look at the big picture and we never give up hope for the future and for what we believe in, which is we will win, and we are winning because people are listening. We've never changed our story for over 500 years as Native people, that we have to protect our mother because she protects us, our earth. So clean air, clean water, you know, just making sure that we're providing a path forward and not just stopping something, but also providing something. And the medicine that is put in the ground is protecting us, but we also, the ground has traumatic memory as well. And so some of the things that happened that were bad, it's because there was a fort there. Fort Rice was put there to go against us. But people listening, please donate to AtretiShekoinCamp.org. AtretiShekoinCamp.org. We can put up the link. We need resources on the ground as winter comes, and we need people to be donating GoPros that we can wear ourselves and other things so that we can continue to tell our own story and do it in a way that's grounded in prayer and ceremony.
Well, we'll definitely include those links. And Simon, just quickly, 30 seconds, what has this meant for you?
Well, again, we're just trying
it
to get
has
ahead
meant
of the bad
that
reporting. We're making sure that if the New York Times is going to come down, if NBC News, and NBC News is there right now, but we're making sure that they talk to the right people. We don't want them just going from camp to camp to camp, because she's right, there are infiltrators, and if infiltrators are giving bad quotes, that reflects poorly on everybody, at the camp. So we're trying to make sure that these reporters are being directed to the right people, vetted people. So that's what we're trying to do, just trying to get ahead of the bad reporting so that people know that these are good people, unarmed people, fighting for their rights, fighting for their human rights, fighting for the safety of their kids, and for the health and well-being of water, your water, our water.
Simon Moya-Smith is culture editor with Indian Country Today, and Candy Mossett is a member of the Mandan and Hidatsa tribes. She's a Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network here in North Dakota. Simon and Candy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.